We are starting a new chapter in the book of Romans tonight. We have been working our way diligently through the details of Paul's presentation of God's case against humanity. We know that Romans is designed by Paul, according to the opening statement in the first seven verses, that he is going to lay out the gospel of God. But the good news that God has for us has a backdrop of the bad news that is the reason why the good news is good news. If you don't have bad news, good news loses its goodness. I mean, if you don't have a need, then a promise of provision for the need is no big deal. But the gospel is a big deal, and what we want to understand is the issue. And last week we spent all of our time in verse 32 dealing with just how serious that issue is, because it's a matter of eternal death. And the people in verse 32 know that those who practice the kinds of things that are outlined in verses 29 through 31 are worthy of death, and they do them anyway. So it's interesting that when Paul moves into chapter 2, and you have to keep in mind that Paul didn't write the chapter divisions and the verse divisions. He didn't have a chapter 2. He just had the next thought on his mind. It's only because of the translation into English and the desire to be able to organize the material in a way that makes it easy to find various and sundry places that we have chapter and verse divisions, which were created by people after the fact. So when we go into chapter 2, we're actually just moving to the next thought, and it's not a disconnected one. He says, therefore, you are without excuse, every man of you who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. Well, that without excuse business had its origins back in verse 20. Because in verse 20 he said, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, the two that are crucial, his eternal power and what is translated divine nature, but it has to do with his identity as the personal God, his eternal power and personality as deity have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. So this business of being without excuse is a rather serious thing in light of the consequence that is laid out in verse 32. It's also very critical in light of all of the things that God has done in response to them in verses 24, 26, and 28 of chapter 1. But that's material that we've covered. This evening we're going to begin to look at Paul's second line of laying out God's case against man. It was his objective in verses 18 through 32 of chapter 1 to lay out God's case against humanity for rejecting the life of the servant God. Now those terms, the life of the servant God, are not in that text, but they show up in terms of the concepts throughout the text, because the issue of knowing God and rejecting Him as God, professing to be wise, becoming fools, changing the glory of the incorruptible God for the image of the form of corruptible alternative deities, those are all issues of man's desire to reject life as it is defined by the God who defines life. And it's not that men don't like life, it's that they don't want it on His terms. And so the issue is that in chapter 1, Paul laid out this case that God has against humanity for rejecting the life of the servant God. The only option that is open to man once he's rejected the life option is the death option. You know, only live or die. Those are the only two options you have. So if you're going to reject the life option, then the death option's an automatic, and according to verse 32, they know that. So let me just kind of ease our way into this study by saying it kind of like this. If there is a God, and if there is a Most High God, remember that the Romans were in a polytheistic culture where they had multiple Roman deities, Zeus and, you know, all those guys, kind of superhuman demigod kind of things. In that kind of a polytheistic setting, you had this concept of the Most High God that Luke picked up on in Luke and Acts and used pretty consistently through there. And, of course, Luke was Paul's sidekick for years, so the issue in Romans is that there is a Most High God, there is a God, and if there is such a God as has been revealed clearly, verse 20, so that they are clear on this, verse 19 says God made it evident to them so that there isn't any way that they can be ignorant of it, because God's ability to make it evident to them takes all of the things that might be in their heads mentally that would keep them from thinking straight about that. God has overruled all of that and made it evident. That's why the scriptures are so adamant that it is only a fool who says there's no God, because in order to say there's no God, you have to simply close your eyes, close your mind, and open your mouth and say the words. Because God has made it evident. There's not going to be any kind of an excusability factor in the day of judgment based on this. But that's what verse 20 says. They're without excuse. Well, verse 1 of chapter 2 says, you're without excuse too, addressing a certain type of thinker. But if there is such a God, and if he has made it most evident that he does exist, and he is the Most High God, he's the only God you have to worry about, it should go without saying, given the reality of the fact of God, it should go without saying that this God who is going to be the final arbiter of all definitions. So that whatever he says life is life. And whatever he says is death, because he is the author of the definitions. And the fact is inescapable that both reality and the definitions of reality exist, and men know them, at least generally. Life is defined. Death is defined. And you can't reject the definitions without embracing the results that your rejection creates for you. I mean, you can't do what they did in verse 23, exchange the glory of the incorruptible for the form of the corruptible, without creating for yourself all kinds of consequences that you're going to have to live with, because they're inherent in the definition. You walk away from God, you're walking away from life. You walk away from life, you're walking into death. Death is a real phenomenon, and the consequences of existing in death are horrible, but that's what you walk into when you walk away from life, and there isn't anything you can do about it. The one thing that we do know about God is that men aren't God, and they cannot control their experiences at a significant level of control. The problem for man is that he wishes to reject the definitions without being subject to the consequences. He wants to be able to do what he wants to do without any kind of death consequences being the consequence of his choices. He just wants to be free to live however he wants to and have all the consequences be good. Well, that's not possible. Even believers living absolutely faithfully in a fallen world are not going to have everything work out positively. I mean, Jesus came, lived absolutely perfectly, and his enemies murdered and crucified him. He ran into all kinds of static because he was working within the context of an evil fallen world. Well, we're still there. So, the problem is, man, in general, wants to define things the way he wants to define them, and then have it happen that way, but he is not the origin of reality. Man is not the measure of what he is. And because he's not the origin of reality, he finds himself incapable of satisfying his wish. He wishes to reject the definitions that God has imposed upon his creation without being subject to the consequences of that rejection, and yet he cannot satisfy that wish. He finds himself subject to the definitions. Man knows with all of his experience that there is a worthiness of death in all those who reject life and promote their rejection by their actions. That's what verse 32 says point blankly. They know this. They know it on the basis of all of their experience. That's why the intensified term for know is there. They know that those who practice such things are worthy of death. They know that. There is no doubt about that. So in chapter 2, verse 1, where Paul just picks up his next line of thought, he takes the issue another step further, and this evening we're going to look at this second presentation of God's case against man in terms of his inexcusability. So that's the first thing that I want us to think about this evening. When he says, therefore you are without excuse, every man of you who passes judgment, I want us to think about this business of being without excuse for a little while. There is this whole business of why Paul would even talk about men being without excuse. He started in verse 20 of chapter 1, now he says it again. He's trying to create this impression that you're without excuse. Why? What is this business of inexcusableness? In chapter 1, verse 20, man's inexcusableness was founded upon his certain knowledge of the contradiction between what he knew and what he decided. Because it says he was without excuse because he knew clearly about God's power and divine nature. And then in verse 21, he did not honor God as God, and he was not thankful. So that Paul's saying your inexcusability rests upon the fact that you know, and then you choose contrary to what you know. And so in that place, the issue was man's certain knowledge of the reality of God, a reality that God underwrites so that nobody can escape it. It's not an accident that there are only a few atheists, percentage-wise, in all of humanity. It's not an accident because you have to have gone a long way into your non-think mindset to ever get there. Even with a non-think mindset, even though God has turned them over to a reprobate mind, verse 28, they still know this. So now, in verse 1 of chapter 2, Paul returns to this issue. Man continues to be without excuse, but in this second statement, Paul is switching from what man knows about the reality of God to what man knows about the reality of the morality of God. Because he says, you're without excuse when you pass judgment. In that, when you judge another, you condemn yourself. Now, there's a lot of people who think that that means that you shouldn't pass judgment. That's not what he's saying. Passing judgment is necessary to life. You have to make decisions all the time. There isn't any way you can keep from making judgments. He's not saying it's bad to make judgments. What he's saying is it leaves you without excuse because you can make them and then turn right around and break them yourself. The issue is not that we shouldn't make judgments. Even the statement that Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged, does not mean don't make judgments. He's talking about a way, an attitude that you take when you're making judgments. But the truth of the matter is, Paul is saying that man knows more than that God is. He also knows a certain level of the morality of God. And so in this second statement, he switches from the certain knowledge, verse 32, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, to a different word for knowing. When he says, you're without excuse, every one of you who passes judgment, for in that you judge, you condemn yourself. Or you judge another, you condemn yourself, because you who judge practice the same thing. And we know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice such things. Well, this know in verse 2, we know, is not the same word in verse 32 of chapter 1. It's a different word, and it's a word that has to do with intellectual, rational comprehension. In verse 32, he was talking about experiential knowledge, knowledge that you can't escape because it's in all of your experiences. But in verse 2 of chapter 2, when he says, we know the judgment of God rightly falls, he's saying this is just a reasonable conclusion. We have the ability to rationally conclude that it's legitimate for God's judgment to come upon those who do what verse 1's talking about. So he's just talking about rational certainty. We had experiential certainty in verse 32. Now we have rational certainty in chapter 2, verse 2. So there's this business of inexcusability arising from both experience and reason. Men are going to be without excuse by reason of their experience and their ability to think, even though that ability to think has been severely marred by God's action in verse 28. Second, there is this issue of why Paul keeps hammering on being inexcusable. What's the deal about man wanting to be excusable? What is it about a person wanting to have an excuse? That all men have the innate desire to be excused is clearly observable everywhere. All you have to do to see it in action is to accuse somebody of something. If you accuse them of something, there will be an immediate response. And if what you're accusing them of is bad, the response will be one of several. They'll either deny it, or they'll try to explain why it's true but it's not bad, or they'll just hit you in the mouth with their fist. I mean, they're going to react. If you make an accusation of evil against somebody, you'll find out immediately that Paul was touching a nerve when he said, "You're without excuse. You're without excuse." Because men want to have excuses. They seem to have a fundamental need to be excused. And you can see this everywhere. There is always a reaction in accusation that's rooted in the desire to explain why the accusation is either not true or it's acceptable behavior. I mean, I know I did this, but the reason I did is this. Well, what is all this but the reason? It's just trying to make it appear to be something better than it is. So even if a person just looks at you, glares at you for making the accusation, turns around and walks away without saying or doing anything else, that reaction is nonetheless, it falls into the category of a desire to squelch the accusation, to not let that accusation stand. What's driving that? What is it about man that makes him always want to justify himself? To be okay. How come people can write books like "I'm Okay, You're Okay" and sell millions of copies of it? What is it that drives man about that? What is it about being accused of something less than sterling goodness that makes us automatically want to try to polish up the image? The question is, why does man feel so sensitively the accusation that you're without excuse? Well, I think we've already seen that. Verse 32 of chapter 1 is the reason. You see, the issue in chapter 1, verse 32, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, in a very real sense, you could put a capital D on the word death, because he's not just talking about corporal punishment, physical stuff. He's talking about being subjected to the eternal reality of total death. That whole issue that we studied last time. Well, that concept of total death for all eternity without relief or release is such a threat that nobody wants to be guilty enough to be put there. Everybody wants to have some way to get out from under the condemnation of eternal death. We don't want to be guilty enough to be cast into the lake of fire. The very idea that there is such a thing as final death is so horrifying to humanity that deep inside of us, where we don't even know where what we value or what we love or what even we're thinking, deep down inside of there is this terrified reaction to being guilty. That's why Paul puts his finger on this issue, because he's trying to create a sense of guilt. You see, there's no salvation where there's no guilt. He's not doing it to be mean, but he is doing it. And the whole issue is that man knows two things for sure. In verse 32, the suggestion is, man knows he's not powerful enough to alter fundamental reality. Man knows that. He has a sense of mortality. He knows that he cannot stop the God from doing whatever he pleases. And he knows that he lives under a sentence of death because it's one of those 100% issues. Everybody that you ever know has either died or is going to. And there's no escape. And men know that. There, it's deep inside our psyche that we know that. I was listening to the news this evening. The flash, new news. What's going on? Well, some lady had a friend that worked for Caterpillar somewhere up here in North Carolina that got fired. And this lady got so angry that her friend got fired that she took a shotgun and went into the building and took five people hostage. And of course, you know, the cop cars and all this stuff. And had to... What was going on there is that she was using the threat of what everybody already knows can happen. You can die. And she was using the shotgun as a way to try to force something better to be done than what was done. And after a few hours, she gave up her gun. Nobody got hurt, but she didn't get away either. And the point is, men inherently know that they do not have the power to run the universe the way they want it to run so that they can come out with everything their way. Men know that. There are a lot of us that fight it, but we know it. The second thing that man, that's true of man, he's not stupid enough to resist the charge that he's guilty of rejecting the life of the servant God. Men know that they have walked away from life as defined by the servant God. Men know that they're not committed to being the servants of their fellow man or the servants of God. They know that. I preached a sermon one time when we were studying Romans in another place, and we finally got to chapter 12. So I was preaching on Romans 12, 1 and 2, where you present your body a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, so that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God, so that you're not conformed to this world, but you're transformed. And in the sermon, I was just trying to urge believers to present their bodies as a living sacrifice to God. And one of my best friends came up after the service and said, "That's really scary." He was just being honest. Most of us are a little bit afraid of what it might mean to be a servant of God or of our neighbor or whatever. And so because of that, we know that we have not embraced the servant mindset. Well, the world knows that it hasn't either. I mean, there's a lot of platitude talk that tries to snow it. But we're without excuse because we know better. So the conclusion seems to be that man attempts to block the accusation that he's guilty. But those attempts to block that accusation are driven by the sure knowledge that he is being waited for by death. And he cannot mount a legitimate defense. He knows he deserves to die. That's why Paul presses the issue. You're without excuse. Then there's the reason as why we're without excuse. In Romans 2, 1 and 2, as we've already said, man's lack of excuse rests upon his inescapable rationality. Verse 28 is true, that God did turn man over to a non-think mind. In some ways, man's reasonableness has been turned on its head because God, in response, gave him over to a non-think mind. But it's also true that even a non-think mind cannot escape the basic law of fundamental consistency because there's nothing you can do without the law of consistency. There is nothing you can do or even learn without consistency. How do you learn anything you learn? Except by repetition. And repetition demands consistency. If every time you did something, it created a different result, you'd never learn anything except that you couldn't learn anything. Because consistency is absolutely essential. In fact, somebody said, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing 1,000 times and expecting a different result every time. People, you know, keep butting your head against the same old thing, expecting something to change. It's not going to change. That's the issue of consistency. You do this and this will be the result. That's the issue. That's how we learn. And therefore, it is impossible, even for somebody who's just shredded their rationality, or had it shredded for them, it's even impossible for that individual to function without understanding that there is this thing called consistency. And that's the foundation of his rationality concerning judgment in verse 1. You see, his rationality has to do with his ability to make moral decisions. You can't pass judgment, like the verse says, without making a statement about what ought to be. You can't say, "Why, you shouldn't have done that," or "you ought to have done that," unless there is a sense of morality built in that undergirds your statement. Now, you can't pass judgment without already knowing that there are certain things that are right and certain things that are not right. I call that the sense of ought. We all have a sense that this ought to be or ought not to be. Now, I will admit that most men have twisted this sense of ought, but even after twisting it, they can't get away from it. Most people think that what ought to be is what they want to be. You ought to do this. Why? Because I want you to. It is not right for you to do that. Why? Because I don't want you to do that. But even that twistedness, which is making me the God who's defining what ought not to be, even in that twistedness, there's still this ought thing. You still know that you ought or you ought not. Well, anybody who ever says, "You shouldn't have done that," or "You should have done that," has rendered himself without excuse. Not because the decision or the statement's wrong, but because of what he goes on to say. In the very thing that you judge another, you condemn yourself because you do the very thing that you said, "I shouldn't do." You know, most people handle this sense of ought by moving into the camp of "you ought" as opposed to "I ought." In other words, we're more concerned about what others ought to be doing than we are about what we ought to be doing. That's why we sit in criticism on other people without being critical of ourselves. But the whole statement, "you ought to do this," means that I can make a decision about the legitimacy of your actions. And the statement, "you ought," renders me inexcusable if I do what I say you ought not to do, or if I don't do what I say you ought to do. The ought generally means that I've already made a moral decision, and the problem with "you ought to do this or not to do that" generally means that my attention's been captured by your behavior, and that leaves me inattentive to my own behavior, and therefore I'm blind to the fact that I'm a hypocrite. But the reality is, there isn't a man alive, there isn't a person alive, who does as well as he knows. And the proof of it is, in the reality that I've observed many, many times, I've listened to people scream bloody murder while engaging in bloody murder. What I mean by that is, I've listened to people complain on and on and on about all the improper behavior that other people are engaging in, while the person doing the complaining has no interest in walking with God or doing His will. Now, how hypocritical is that? That's just one sinner screaming at another sinner for sinning. If I'm not willing to be a servant follower of the servant God, I have no right to criticize anybody for anything, because I'm not doing my most fundamental responsibility. And if I'm not going to do my fundamental responsibility, that means that I will be doing the very things that I'm criticizing other people for doing. And that leaves me rationally without an excuse. What kind of excuse can you give for hypocrisy? The very fact that there is an ought in the face of the consistency principle means that what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If you ought to do it, then I ought to do it. And if I ought to do it and I don't do it, then where is my excuse? So if I can say you ought or you ought not, and then I act in contradiction to what I've said, then I'm left with no excuse. I already know it's wrong. I just did it. Well, that's what verse 32 says. They know that those who practice such things are worthy of death, but they do the same thing and give hearty approval to those who do them. This is a condition of man that he can't escape. Now, this issue of man's lack of escape further rests on another inescapable fact, and that is the thing I just mentioned, that everybody knows better than he does. Nobody lives up to their sense of what ought to be done when it's applied to others. Therefore, he has no excuse when it's applied to himself. Let me see if I can bring this down to greater clarity. Paul says in verse 1 that if there's a breakdown between what I think you ought to do and what I do, then I'm under condemnation. I condemn myself because I render myself without excuse. I have done the thing I knew would bring death, even though I've said you shouldn't do it. So I'm without excuse and I'm under condemnation. Condemnation is the sentence of death. Verse 32. In the court of justice, what can a man say who is guilty of doing the very thing that he acknowledged he knew was wrong by telling somebody else they shouldn't do it? Now, how does this really work, though? Well, how it works is like this. Jesus said on one occasion that you ought to treat others like you want to be treated. You know how man handles that? He says, others ought to treat me like I want to be treated. That's the way we handle it. You should treat me like I want to be treated. And as long as I'm on your case, you can't get on mine. At least, I hope you can't. I was listening to the news yesterday because they were talking about the election and how the election has divided the country and has also divided households. They had this man and this woman. The man was for Kerry and the woman was for Bush. And they quit talking to each other. They'd been married for all these years, but they quit talking to each other. And the reason was, the man said, it stuck in my craw that I was married to a woman that would vote for a man that I considered to be totally immoral. And she said, you know, things didn't thaw around here until I told him that he loved Kerry more than he loved me. And I thought, yeah, but he could have said you love Bush more than you love me, too. When you're screaming bloody murder at somebody else's failure, you better have your closet clean. Because if you don't, you're just doing bloody murder while you're screaming it. The problem with us is that we always sense the injustice when it's done to us, and we almost never sense it when we're doing it to somebody else. That's the problem with our corruption and the sinfulness issue. We are extremely sensitized to how people treat us, and it's extremely dull in realizing how we treat others. That's a problem. That's a huge problem. But the reality is that because it's real, it's a problem, but it's a real issue. We pass judgment on other people for doing things that we then turn right around and do ourselves. And when that happens, we render ourselves rationally inexcusable. That means death can come upon us and we won't have anything to say about it not being legitimate to come upon us. We're guilty. So the final conclusion that we come to in that is that nobody escapes the personal failure of living up to his own ideals. Every one of us struggles with the fact that we don't feel like that we're living up to our own ideals, let alone God's. And this leads us in mortal danger in a universe where justice will prevail unless there's a solution. Now, in the book of Romans, there is a solution, and it's the gospel. But let me caution you about the solution issue. The gospel does not promise that in this world you'll ever get to where you can treat others like you want to be treated consistently. It doesn't make that promise to you. It does promise that someday we're going to get there. But it doesn't promise it in this world. Even the Apostle Paul, in writing to the Philippians, admitted that he was in process. He said, I haven't arrived. I have not attained. But I press forward toward the mark for the prize of the high calling. Well, what he's admitting is that the theology of the New Testament is not a theology of attaining perfection in moral performance in this world, in this lifetime. Even by the Spirit, the man that we've been studying, his parents in Luke chapter 1, John, known as the Baptist or the Baptizer, was predicted by Gabriel to be filled with the Holy Spirit from his mother's womb. That means all of his lifetime. Before he ever started acting in this world outside of his mother's womb, he was already filled with the Spirit. So if there was ever a man who lived life like it ought to have been lived, other than Jesus, you would think it would have been John. Nobody else in all of history that we know of was filled with the Spirit from his mother's womb until the day of his death. But when Jesus came to be baptized by John, what did John tell him? I'm not worthy to baptize you. In fact, he told those that he was with, I'm not even worthy to untie the thong of his sandals. Well, now, what is this worthy business? This worthy business is moral. I am made unworthy by immoral attitudes, actions, or whatever. If I wasn't made immoral by attitudes and actions, I would be worthy. I'd be qualified. So here's a man filled with the Spirit from his mother's womb who had a deep, abiding sense of his own sinfulness. It was probably more profound than anybody else's because he was filled with the Spirit from his mother's womb. I haven't found in my lifetime that people who are really filled with the Spirit get away from their sense of personal bankruptcy. What I have found is that there are a whole lot of people who are claiming to be filled with the Spirit who have no sense of personal bankruptcy, and therefore I know they're not filled with the Spirit. I know they're just blowing gas in the wind, you know. It's just... Because when you're that close to God, you feel your inadequacy, your sinfulness. So my point is this. Nobody escapes the personal failure of living up to our ideals. Not even Spirit-filled people do. The gospel doesn't provide for that in this world in terms of making us perfect in our behavior. What is the gospel? The gospel is that there was somebody else who was perfect, who lived up to the extraordinary ideals of God's perfect justice and righteousness, and then died in my place and was willing to impute his righteousness to me as a gift when I was willing to put my trust in him. That's the gospel. So it's a gospel substitution. And being a gospel substitution means that though he purchased for me eternal life, my full experience of that in moral terms is awaiting the day when my body is redeemed and I'm finally perfected. Until then, it's just root hog or die. You know, it's scratch and try. It's the whole business of seeking to be consistent in depending on God day by day, even though we know that we're not going to be consistent depending on Him day by day. I mean, we haven't lived this long without understanding that we drop the ball too often. Paul is not trying in chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, when he says, you're without excuse. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice. So he's not trying to take a believer's sense of security away from him. He's trying to create a tremendous sense of insecurity for people who have not believed the gospel. So don't get hung up on that. I don't mind as much anymore being without excuse as I used to. I've discovered over time that being accused of evil is an ego thing. I defend myself out of ego reasons. I've discovered that it doesn't hurt to say, well, you know, you're right. I have the freedom to say that because I'm no longer threatened by the death. Jesus took that from me. The threat's gone. Therefore, I can admit what God already knows is true, and you do too. So I haven't achieved perfection in this. I still get angry sometimes when people accuse me of stuff. But I get angrier when they're right than I do when they're wrong. But the anger dissipates more rapidly now because I don't have to be perfect anymore. It's not a necessity. I don't have a death sentence hanging over my head in case I've dropped the ball. So that's what's going on in verses 1 and 2. Paul is trying to build the case that he started building in verse 20, that men don't have an excuse. We just don't have an excuse. There is no excuse. We know the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice evil. We know that. It's not questionable. It's a fact. We know that we are guilty. We know that we have come legitimately under condemnation if we're going to approach God on the basis of performance. We know that. It's a done deal. There's no escape from it. Even though the vast majority of humanity will try to escape it from the time they first begin to realize it till the day they die, they will keep trying to escape the sentence of condemnation because of the guilt by excuses. But there aren't any. Okay? That's what I plan to say. Anybody got any comments or questions they want to make before we... He's still dealing with God's case against humanity, but in chapter 1 it was based on experience. In chapter 2 it's more rationality. Experience and reason. They know and they do. I mean, it's the same foundation. They're still doing contrary to what they know. But the kind of knowing is different. In a sense, chapter 2 verse 1 is shifting into the mindset of the moralist who considers himself better than other people. And he sits in judgment on them. And he thinks by sitting in judgment on them that he's better than they are. And Paul says, not as long as you're doing the same things that they are. And there isn't any of us that can escape that accusation because it's true. We do the very things we criticize. Now, we may not do exactly the same thing, but you know, Jesus pushed the limits. He pushed the boundaries of definition. There were a whole lot of Pharisees in Paul's day who would scream bloody murder if he accused them of being adulterers. Because they would say, I have never slept with another man's wife in my life. You can't accuse me of that. Well, Jesus would come along and say, yeah, but that's because you've defined adultery in terms of your external performance stuff rather than dealing with it in your heart. If you've ever looked at a woman and lusted after, you're already guilty. Same thing John did in 1 John when he said, you say you love God and you hate your brother. You're a liar. He pushes these envelopes to motive. And when you get pushed to the issue of motive, you can't stand it. The motives are not good. More times than not, they're not good. Believers, I think sometimes we discount how much impact the Spirit of God does have on us. Because it is by the Spirit of God that we come to the kind of humility that enables us to get along with one another and tolerate the imperfections of one another because we tolerate our own. There are no relationships that are better than those that are built on the clear understanding that this relationship is not good because I'm good. I've watched married couples, for example, and the marriages go bad pretty fast when one of them thinks that they deserve to be treated a certain way. But the relationships really build strongly when both of them feel like, boy, I got the better end of this deal by marrying that person. That's just the way it works. You have a self-righteous person and the relationships go pfft. But you have somebody who's got a good, healthy dose of humility and the relationships are good. And that's the benefit that the Spirit grants to us because He creates that sense of humility in us by making us aware of just how often we do fall. And because we're aware of it, then we stop demanding that others do better than we do. Okay? Anything else? Well, batten down the hatches. We're not going to get out of the negative stuff till we get out of the middle of chapter 3. So, I mean, I've told you this before, but just be aware, Paul's building a case. Let's have a word of prayer together. Father, we are aware of at least some of what you had to deal with in dealing with our sin. And we're so grateful to you for providing a substitute who was willing in his own great love and mercy to come and take our place, so that even in our guilt we can have confidence. We're grateful that you've made it possible for us to be regenerated and have a living hope for what you're going to ultimately do in the future. And we pray that you'll set that hope before us day after day so that we can live in the light of it. We commit ourselves to you for this necessary work in our hearts. In the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.